I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. 16 protesters were arrested this morning when they refused to leave City Hall after a City Council committee voted to approve Police Commissioner Kevin Davis's permanent appointment. WIPR reporter P. Kenneth Burns fills us in at noon. Then, in 2 weeks, the Justice Department will release 6,000 drug offenders from federal prisons. In Maryland, that means 140 inmates will be released from federal custody, from prisons, reentry facilities, or home detention. What's next for them? Some observers see the release as a small but crucial step in fixing a broken justice system. Others worry that a release of this size will be followed by a wave of crime. We'll hear from both sides and learn about the largest federal reentry facility in Maryland after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us today. At the top of the show, we want to cover some news at Baltimore City Hall. Late yesterday, a City Council committee approved making permanent the appointment of interim Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. Davis was appointed in July by Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake after she fired the former commissioner, Anthony Batts. The committee voted yesterday 3-1 in favor of giving Davis the permanent title. Councilman Nick Mosby was the only no vote. Councilman Carl Stokes abstained. Davis's confirmation will now go to the full City Council next week. Protesters gathered at City Hall last night during the committee meeting. Take a listen.
Stop the vote! 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 Stop the vote!
Stop the vote. They went, the vote stopped. And early this morning, Baltimore police arrested 16 individuals who were still at City Hall hours after the committee had voted. P. Kenneth Burns, WIPR city reporter, has been covering this issue, and he joins me now in Studio A. Welcome back to the show, Kenny.
Groovy. Thank you for having me.
Groovy? Really? Okay. Kenny, who are these protesters, and what is their issue?
It's a coalition of grassroots activists. For a long time, they've been watching police accountability, and they've been challenging the police department for their past practices. Of course, the most recent one, Freddie Gray.
So, are they specifically opposed to Kevin Davis getting the title of permanent, or that wouldn't be part of his title, but losing the interim in front of police commissioner? Is this about Davis in particular, or other issues?
It's partly about Davis, but it includes other issues. As far as Davis, they've been demanding a meeting. In fact, they did demand a meeting with him and the mayor. I talked with Kwame Rose, one of the protesters. He held a protest this morning trying to organize bail for the 16 arrestees. He said that Davis last night had a chance to show he is willing to engage with all sides, but he didn't rise to the challenge.
So they're not happy about Kevin Davis getting a permanent title as police commissioner. What else are they unhappy about?
Well, they have three issues that they espoused this morning. They want Commissioner Davis to take back his claim that he would treat protest as protest and riots as riots. They believe that he didn't keep up that end.
I'm sure I follow that. He has said he's making a distinction between protests and riots, and they don't think he's making a sufficient distinction.
Right.
Okay.
The second issue is Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano. They want him out because of the allegations involving some maintenance workers at Gilmore Homes. As you know, the allegation last week that some of them have been asking for sexual favors from female residents before repairs were made at their home. And he says that Gilmore, and remember, this is the same neighborhood where the Freddie Gray arrest originally took place. Rose said that neighborhood continues to be victimized by the city. And they also want the $20 million that the state approved for the youth jail to be allocated to social justice programs.
So a continuing controversy over the youth jail.
Right.
So those are their demands. 16 were arrested early this morning. There were continuing protests later in the morning. No arrests, no new arrests from that. So what do we know about the 16 who were arrested?
All but two of them are from Baltimore City. One was from Montgomery County. The other one from Columbia. The three juveniles, they're only identified as two males and one female. They are Baltimore City residents. All of them are facing trespassing charges.
Trespassing is the charge.
Yes.
And do you have any sense of whether more protests are planned or what kind of happens next in this story?
Well, right now they're working on getting funds together for if and when bail is assessed. We do not know if bail has been assessed for the 16 or at least the 13, because the three juveniles, they'll likely get turned over to their parent or guardian, assuming that bail's not set for them. There were about 12 protesters in front of City Hall this morning to highlight the issues that they have concerns about, in addition to the issues that carried over from last night.
Well, I appreciate you bringing us up to date, Kenny. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to be following this issue on Midday. We'll have more about it tomorrow at noon, so tune in then. Let's take a broader look now at criminal justice. I'm Sheila Cass. This is Midday. Let's look at the federal system. Criminal justice reform may well be a major talking point on the campaign trail in 2016. A little later, we'll get an idea about legislation before Congress, whether easing up on mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenders is a financial and ethical boon for Americans or a dangerous risk for public safety. But first, we're just over 2 weeks away from what is apparently one of the biggest discharges ever of inmates from the federal prison system. When the Justice Department confirmed the release last week, it said that the release of 6,000 drug offenders is both an effort to reduce overcrowding in federal prisons and to reduce harsh sentences meted out to drug offenders over the past three decades. About a third of the 6,000 inmates set to be discharged are undocumented immigrants who will be deported upon their release. 140 of the inmates will be returning to Maryland. And to get a sense of how big a deal this is and what the implications are, we've asked Jim Wyda to join us. Jim Wyda is federal public defender for the District of Maryland. His office is representing many of the 140 inmates who are returning to Maryland. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
And also with us in studio is Jim Sense, Vice President of Corrections, Veterans, and Housing Services for Volunteers of America. He's been working with the Residential Reentry Facility in East Baltimore, the largest reentry facility in the state, since 1989. Long time. Welcome to the show.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much.
So, either of you, walk me through where we are with these 140 inmates whose sentences are being effectively shortened. Well, first of all, Jim Wyda, let me ask you, as a lawyer, I mean, is it right to say that their sentences are being shortened? And if so, by how much? I mean, how long would we have expected most of these prisoners to, how much time would we have expected them to serve? How much time are they actually serving? Do you know?
So let me pull back a little bit and place it in a little bit of context. From my perspective, this is an important small step on the path to reforming our criminal justice system that many, including Justice Breyer, recently think is broken because of the excessive sentences given in both the state and the federal system. In April of 2014, the United States Sentencing Commission took a small step to make some progress on that front. They agreed to reduce sentences for all drug defendants by two levels, and they made that retroactive.
And most of us have no idea what a level is in a sentence.
Sure. So a level translates roughly into a year and a half, 2 years of less prison time for the individual. What we're really talking about today is an important decision they made was to make it retroactive.
Mm-hmm.
But they also made another important decision, which was that they were going to delay the implementation of that guideline, of that change in the federal sentencing law by a year so that everyone could get ready for this. One of the reasons why you have the significant numbers that you have being released here is because everyone's release dates sort of stacked up waiting for November 1st. You've got a year's worth of release dates that have accumulated, which is you know, which has created the number, but we've also, you know, built in a year so that a bunch of folks could get ready. If I could say one more thing about the process, the way it worked with the retroactivity is defense lawyers made motions on behalf of clients. Generally, lawyers from my office made those
public
motions. Public defenders from my office making them to federal judges. The U.S. Attorney's Office weighed in, got a chance to oppose, and judges made the decision as to whether the individuals were both legally eligible for the relief and also whether they served any sort of danger to the community and hence shouldn't be released. It's through that process that these individuals have made it through, and now we have 6,000 nationally and 140 locally teetering on the brink of release.
So I'd be correct if I infer that the 140, and by the way, are they all male, or are there women in this group too?
I believe there are some women.
Okay,
you know, it's
so
a very small number.
We won't call them guys then, mm-hmm. but the 140 prisoners who will be released in a couple of weeks, every one of those releases was approved by a federal judge.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's, okay. And so you say that release dates stacked up. Is this an ongoing process?
Yep. This will, I mean, again, one important clarification, and in most of these cases, the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't oppose. I mean, there was some litigation over this, but in the most part, this was done by consensus. The probation officers, prosecutors, defenders, and judges working together to sort of make this work efficiently and well. But this is going to be an ongoing process, you know, nationally and locally. In probably the next couple of years in Maryland, we expect a few hundred more to be released. And again, thousands more nationally will be released as their due dates come up after this process.
And I am confused about how a sentence that has been imposed by a judge in mm-hmm. a legal proceeding can be retroactively amended mm-hmm. by the U.S. Sentencing Commission.
So, again, the way this has worked in this case, and it works differently in a couple of different contexts. Sometimes there's a change in law that'll be made retroactive. Here, this is a decision made by the Sentencing Commission, and then Congress gets an opportunity to act. They can reverse the Sentencing Commission's actions. They chose not to. So, again, Congress has placed its imprimatur on this.
Okay, but it is still mm-hmm. the overriding of, I mean, if a federal judge said 10 years and now this new guideline says should have been 8, it seems to me it's overriding what a judge in a particular case said.
But again, that's a very good question. And sort of what's going on here is that the law has been deemed sort of unfair to have been illegal the way the sentences were imposed at the time. And the cases are going back to the same judge. And so the same judge has been given sort of the advisory guidelines have changed. And this is now what the guidelines are recommending is the sentence. And it's still within your discretion as to what sentence you impose. Again, for a very long time, especially in the federal system, but nationally, we have imposed extremely severe sentences on drug defendants. These are primarily poor people, overwhelmingly people of color, many of them with mental health issues, many of them with substance abuse issues. And this is this is a small step on the way to what I hope is a more serious look at how we handle our criminal justice system.
That's Jim Wyda, who is the federal public defender in Maryland here on Midday. I just want to pull quickly Jim's sense from Volunteers of America in to tell us. So these 140 inmates that Jim Wyda and I have been talking about being released, where are they right now in the process? They haven't been released quite yet. What's going on with them right now? Do you know?
I think many of them are with us now in our reentry center. We've seen an increase and an effect of this change on increased admissions to our program. So
you have a lot. I mean, where is your reentry center? The one that one where you have worked for 25 years. Where is it?
It's in East Baltimore.
Uh huh. And is it more crowded than usual?
It is. Early this morning, I noticed we set a record for our population. It was at 212 total.
And that's 212 people living there?
147 out of 148 beds were full this morning. We had 65 clients on home confinement.
So the reentry program covers both people physically on premises and people who are on home detention.
Yes.
And this is all sort of part of the process of getting released.
Yes,
ma'am. Is to go through that. We're going to talk more about that after we take a break. That is Jim Sense from Volunteers of America. He has worked for, 26 years at the part of his work has been at the Reentry Center in Baltimore. Also with us is Jim Wyda, the federal public defender for Maryland. And you can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 if you have some thoughts about federal drug sentences, whether it's a good idea or whether it worries you that these inmates are getting out early. 866, that our local number is 410-662-8780. You can call long distance, 866-661-9309, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about criminal justice and sentencing, especially for drug crimes. Federal prisons are set to release 6,000 people convicted of drug offenses early between October 30th and November 2nd. We're continuing our conversation with James Wyda, the federal public defender for the District of Maryland, and Jim Sense, Vice President of Corrections, Veterans, and Housing Services for Volunteers of America. He's been working with the residential reentry facility in East Baltimore since 1989. I'm trying to get a sense of what is going on with this group of 140 inmates that is different than what normally happens when an inmate is nearing the end of his or her term. Or maybe there's nothing new here. James Wyda, is there something we should know about it?
So I think Jim Sense and I are on the same page about this, but I guess I'll find out shortly. My understanding from talking to folks at the Bureau of Prisons and the probation office is there's nothing really different other than the sheer number that are coming through, which is probably putting some stress on Jim Sense's operation and you know, other players in the system. So there's, you know, there's a volume issue, but a well-funded very professional probation office is in place to work with federal prisoners when they come out of the Bureau of Prisons and out of the halfway house. And so, again, my understanding from talking to probation is they expect to actually devote more resources to these individuals to help them with their transition back into the community.
And they will stay on probation for what would have been the extent of their sentence?
So they're on probation really under the normal time period. It's usually, I think, about 3, potentially 5 years of supervision. So again,
following their time in prison.
Their time in prison. So that is typical, and that'll remain in place. And again, they will work with a talented, well-funded professional probation office that'll help them gain employment, get potential mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment. These folks are not going to be released to the street without support and without supervision. This is actually a very well thought out plan.
Okay, Jim Sense, Jim Wyda said you might disagree with him on something on any of that. Give me your picture of what's going on with these 140 and how it compares to what normally happens.
I think Jim's correct, right on the mark. The only effects I see really is the numbers, as Jim said, have increased, and maybe another effect is everything is a little bit compressed. Due to the advanced release date, their time with us may not be what it normally would have been.
Okay, tell me about that. How long do prisoners normally spend with you when they're getting toward the end of their sentence?
Average about 6 to 9 months.
Oh, 6 to 9, that long?
Yes.
And this group of 140, what's your sense of how long they're spending with you?
Each case is different. Each sentence is unique. But I would say in general, maybe that time has been compressed to maybe 3 to 5 months.
So like maybe half?
Yeah.
Half as much time.
Possibly.
What are they doing and what are you doing during that time that they are with you? What happens in the reentry center?
I got to talk about our staff. We have an excellent, hardworking, committed staff, and everyone kind of works as a team. We have 12 residential services staff and about 35 security staff, and the oversight is done by four administration management staff. And everyone kind of works together. Our job is to help each individual establish a solid release plan so that they can go release from us and go to a stable home, hopefully have employment, and are connected to whatever needs they have, mental health, substance abuse, as Jim indicated. And I also have to talk about our partnership with the U.S. Probation Office. It's been excellent for many, many years. Usually the probation officers become involved with their assigned men and ladies while they're with us and work with our staff to help people formulate strong release plans. We also have a excellent partnership with the Bureau of Prisons Residential Reentry Office in Annapolis Junction. They're truly our partners and have been forever. And I don't know if Jim mentioned that, but their office has certainly seen added stress due to this change and the sentence reductions also.
I get that you're both concerned about stress on the rest of this of the system. I don't understand whether there is – you talked about different times, that different lengths of time that offenders might be spending with you. Who determines that? Are there some benchmarks that they need to reach? Are there some sort of externally verifiable milestones, or does some who makes the evaluation? Because this person is still subject to federal control, right? They even when they leave you will be on probation. So somebody could say, nah, he needs more time. Does that happen? And if so, who decides that? And Jim Sense is looking at Jim Whitehead for that answer.
I think that's a Jim Whitehead question.
So, again, Chili, just so you understand, one of the things that's very helpful about sort of the Halfway House program and, you know, Jim Sense's program in particular is really this designed while people are serving their federal prison sentence, if they meet certain criteria, and I think it's the majority of them, are allowed to serve the last 6 months or so, maybe longer, of their sentence at a halfway house. This is designed to facilitate reentry, to help people. You know, federal prisons are – our clients are held in facilities in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Texas. They're removed from the state of Maryland. They're in remote prisons. And so this is designed to bring folks back halfway, as the language suggests, into the community with a pretty intensive supervision, but allow people to reestablish ties with family members, identify housing and employment, and establish that key relationship with their probation officer. If something goes disastrously wrong and there's misconduct, then I think people can get held up in terms of their release date or get released to more severe probation supervision conditions, but the halfway house placement is designed to facilitate the reentry, even though they're serving the tail end, that last bit of their federal prison sentence.
Let me remind listeners, you can be part of this conversation if you have some thoughts about whether this prison release is a good idea or some concerns about it. Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We got an email from Walt in Baltimore County, I think picking up on a point that you made in passing, Jim Whitehead. Walt asks, has federal probation and pretrial obtained an increase in funds for drug treatment? Is that something you can answer?
So, again, I think I probably don't know very well. I'm making an educated guess here. But my understanding is that their funding has been hurt under the sequester and recently. But my understanding is they still have their funding for drug treatment programs and that type of programming. It's never, you know, money's always a little bit tight. But, again, these are well-funded, very professional offices.
I want to pick up on this idea of the amount of stress on the system, because if I understand what you're telling us, Jim Wyda, the effect of the U.S. Sentencing Commission's decisions basically shortening what these sentences should be and taking that to judge after judge after judge in individual cases means there's going to be an ongoing flow, an increased flow of convicts ending their sentences early. And it sounds to me like you can expect, Jim, sense that your beds are going to be pretty full at the reentry center. Is that something you can cope with over the long term if it stays at this level of full house?
Oh, yes, I believe we can. Our beds are pretty full now. We're looking at about 37 releases on November 1st due to this change, so that's going to alleviate that pressure a lot, maybe unfavorably so from my position, of course, I'm concerned with the finances of the program, and those releases are going to have an effect on that, which isn't positive for me.
Jim Wyda?
Can I just weigh in with a few more numbers? My understanding is that eventually folks anticipate that up to 46,000 prisoners will have their sentences reduced.
Across the country.
Across the country over time here. And again, I think part of the stumbling block was, again, this year delay so that Jim's operation could get ready and probation and the courts could get ready for this first release. And so there was a little bit of a gathering. I expect it will be more gradual.
Of a steady flow.
More gradual
going
in the future,
forward.
So more manageable for the institutions.
But you touched on what I think is a big concern that has been reflected in some of the coverage of this release when we were talking about what it is that a convict needs to be able to show to the satisfaction of his or her probation officer, et cetera. How do we know? How does a judge know even that this is a good risk, that this particular person is not going to reoffend or go back to the life that they that took them to jail in the first place? I mean, what is the level of confidence have?
It's a good question. I mean, I would say it's the same level of confidence that we have in any sentencing decision that we're making. You have players in this decision. You have the probation officer that's done an investigation into the client's background, their family, their criminal history. You have the U.S. Attorney's Office that has some understanding of the individual and the crime. You have the defense attorney that's weighing in on behalf. And then you have a judge making the decision. I think people can be comfortable that there's a great deal of professional judgment that's been put into the process of deciding that an individual should be released. I guess the other small point that I would like to make is we've done this twice before, not to this magnitude, but in 2007 and 2010, there were changes to the crack sentencing guidelines. Again, there was a valid perception that the crack guidelines were having sort of a gross disparity on people of color. And there was reforms to the crack sentencing guidelines, first by the Sentencing Commission and then by Congress. About 30,000 in those two changes benefited from those changes to the federal sentencing system. They did a study after the first release of the 16,000 that benefited from the crack guidelines, and they showed that there was no change in their likelihood of recidivism by releasing them early. So from my perspective, the real story here is people are being kept in federal prison for too long for no real reason. There's individuals that need to be kept away from the community, but we've been far too excessive in our federal sentences. And frankly, one of the reasons why we're doing this is, one, out of a sense of fairness that the sentences have grown too long, but also the Bureau of Prisons is grossly overcrowded. It's 30% to 40% overcrowded, according to testimonies of the director of the Bureau of Prisons. We can't sustain the severity of our criminal justice system anymore.
And you've been talking about the decisions already made by the U.S. Sentencing Commission and previous decisions, but we're also at a point really that seems to be a bipartisan agreement about changing things going forward. We're seeing it in many states. In a couple of weeks here on Midday, we're going to be talking to Governor Hogan's criminal justice advisor about what's going on in Maryland. But this month, we've seen a bipartisan group of U.S. senators reach compromise on reforming federal sentences. I'd like us to hear how Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley, who's chair of the Senate U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, described the compromise they've reached 2 weeks ago.
We preserve Maine mandatory minimums, but we lower some and expand some of the enhanced minimums to make sure that violent and repeat drug offenders stay in prison and out of our communities. But for the first time, we're cutting back many of the most severe mandatory minimums so that they apply more fairly. We're also expanding the current safety valve and even creating a second safety valve so that offenders who have minor criminal histories and play minor roles in drug organizations are not swept up. And we are bringing real reform to our prisons that give low-risk inmates a chance to return to society earlier with better prospects. And most of all, this is a bill that we can be proud of.
So the top Senate Republican on criminal justice issues calls this proposal real reform. James White, are you familiar with this legislation, and does it look like real reform to you?
So I would probably like a different reform. But I will applaud the fact that criminal justice is getting this attention, this bipartisan attention. Those of us, I'm sure your listeners, probably can't pick one or two other things in which in Washington there's a bipartisan consensus. There doesn't seem to be a bipartisan consensus about anything. The notion that there's a consensus about criminal justice reform is a sign of some hope. Again, I would probably like this bill to be more generous to my issues. But again, I would say it's a step in the right direction and it's progress.
I'd like to pull Steve Cook into this conversation. He's on the phone with us from Chattanooga, Tennessee. Steve Cook is president of the National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys, and he has been an outspoken advocate against some of the changes proposed in criminal justice. Steve Cook, welcome to Midday.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm very glad to have you. We just heard Senator Grassley use the term safety valve in describing an element of the legislation that he's proposing. Can you tell our listeners what a safety valve is in this context?
Well, a safety valve was created at one point, the first safety valve, not the one that Senator Grassley spoke to. To make sure that the mandatory minimum penalties for drug offenders didn't sweep up inappropriately some of the low-level offenders who have little or no criminal history or involvement in violent offenses. It's worked especially well, I think.
Okay. We're going to take another break here. I want to continue this conversation about the prospective changes that are being looked at in the federal system as exemplified in this legislation. I'm going to thank Jim Sense of Volunteers of America, Vice President of Corrections, Veterans, and Housing Services for Volunteers of America. I'm going to thank him for his time with us. And before I let you go, just ask if there is something else we should know about this reentry process that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet.
Well, thank you for having us. I really appreciate the time and the effort. And the only thing I would add is I think time in a reentry center is crucial to each individual's successful reintegration into their community. I think these centers are very important. I've been tracking our releases each month for a couple years now. And last year in FY15, 95% of our residents released successfully to their homes. And so I think the importance of centers are evident.
It does. I realize it's hard work, and I'm grateful to you for the work that you're doing. Thank you, and thanks for being with us today. As I said, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back, and we'll still have Jim Wyda, the federal public defender for Maryland, with us, and Steve Cook, from the Association of U.S. Attorneys. And we hope that we will have you also in this conversation. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Stay with us. We'll be back soon. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about criminal justice reform and drug sentences. In particular, we're focused right now on federal legislation, a compromise, bipartisan compromise that has been proposed in the U.S. Senate. With me in the studio is Jim Wyda, who is the federal public defender for the District of Maryland. And joining us by phone from Tennessee is Steve Cook, who's president of the National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys. Steve Cook, your association issued a report this year about what you call, quote, dangerous myths of drug sentencing reform. And the first myth that your report points to is you say it's a myth to say that our prison system is exploding because of the incarceration of drug users. That has become something that gets included in a lot of coverage of this issue. Prove to me it's not true.
Well, it's not true for two reasons. First of all, federal prisons rarely have drug users sent there. In fact, the Sentencing Commission statistics reflect that 0.9% of the prison population is there related to any drug possession offense. Secondly, and maybe more importantly, the prison population is on the decline, not exploding the Federal Bureau of Prisons has suggested through their straight-line statistical analysis that by the end of fiscal year 2016, the Federal Bureau of Prisons will have a drop in the prison population of 11%. Now, that's important, and it's important for a couple of reasons. One of them is that the testimony taken at the Senate reflects that for every 1% drop in the federal prison population, there'll be an increase of 31,000 serious crimes. And that's simply because, and you asked earlier, how do we know that these people who are coming out aren't going to reoffend? And Jim's response to you was their recidivism statistics are the same for the early releasees as the regular prison population. Well, what you need to know about that is that the recidivism rate for people getting out of prison, according to the Sentencing Commission, runs about 43-44%. That's a shockingly high recidivism rate. Bureau of Justice statistics reflect a much higher recidivism rate, as high as 77%. So what that means is early release of these 46,000 prisoners is going to put our public at risk.
So I'm sorry. I want to make sure I'm clear on this, Steve Cook. You're saying that that the experience of recidivism among people who have been convicted of federal drug crimes indicates that something like 3/4 of them will offend again.
That study that dealt with exclusively crack cocaine.
That was crack. So that's generalizable.
That number was 43%. The broader number, the 77%, was actually done by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and it was based on a study of 30 states nationwide.
So are we talking about people convicted under federal law or state laws? If this was
state offenders, and I don't have any reason to think that the folks coming out of federal prison are going to be a lot better.
There's much higher recidivism rates than I have tended to hear from. Let me ask Jim Wyda to respond to Steve Cook's points.
So one, I think the numbers federally are much different. One, because of again the probation resources that we have available for folks. You know, the caseloads for federal probation officers are much more modest. I guess the other thing I'll just note is there's data over and over again from various states that have reduced their prison populations, New York, New Jersey, even Maryland, that reduced their prison populations at the same time you see a decline in crime rates. So, again, this is a change that is percolating throughout the country, and it's having no impact on the increase in crime rates as we begin to get smarter about how we handle our sentencing decisions.
Steve Cook, what about...
Yeah, may I respond to that?
Yes, I was just about to ask you to.
Yeah, thank you. Well, to suggest that there has been no impact from sentencing reform that we've seen, and to be clear, we're talking about two different waves already of early releases of federal prisoners. And as you alluded earlier, there have been approximately 30 states that have gone through sentencing reform, and Jim said with no negative impact. The truth, though, is this. Atlanta has a murder rate up 32%. Baltimore's up 56%. Chicago murder rate up 20%. Houston's up 44%. Los Angeles is up 11%. New York, 9%. Milwaukee, 76%. Minneapolis, 50%. New Orleans, 22%.
Stipulated that murder rates in many cities, including Baltimore, are way up. Your point about that, I mean, are you drawing a direct connection between early release of drug offenders and these homicides?
Well, I think that the point is that we are knee-deep in sentencing reform across the country, and it's time for the reformers to quit claiming it's not having an impact on our crime rates. We're in the middle of one of the worst crime epidemics in the last 25 years.
I'd like to get our listeners' reactions to, because certainly we have covered in Baltimore the heartbreaking increase in shootings, fatal and non-fatal, and I have not seen statistics that link that. I mean, obviously, many of these cases are yet to be made. Many of these homicides have not been solved in Baltimore, so it would be it's setting too high a standard to expect that somebody could tell me what percentage of those shootings are by somebody who had previously been convicted of a federal drug offense. But I would like to get our listeners' thoughts about whether they feel that there is a connection. You can call us at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. And I'd like to get Jim Wyda's thoughts about this.
Sure. Again, just to put this in a little bit of context, our country incarcerates people at a rate unheard of around the world. We have way over 2 million people still, even if we're as suggested, we're knee-deep in sentencing reform, we still incarcerate over 2 million Americans, unlike any other country in the world, unlike China, who we don't compare ourselves to in any way in terms of human rights. So we are an incarcerative nation. And to suggest that somehow the release of some individuals has led to, again, the data completely suggests that there's a steep decline in crime. The National Academy of Sciences, Human Rights Watch, we have Justice Breyer, Rand Paul, and Seth Curry all agreeing that we should reform, disparate fellows like that, all agreeing that we should reform our sentencing system. The 2 million that are incarcerated, the vast majority of those are people of color, poor people, people with profound mental health and substance abuse issues. I think the hope of a lot of folks, including the bipartisan support, is that we can reduce the severity of our sentences and invest in people and our communities to give people better lives.
Let me hear what Marty of Middletown has to say about this. Marty, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, thanks for calling.
I did have a question regarding releasing people into their prior situations. I have a little bit of experience with trying to rehabilitate from they told me in rehab was you have to change people, places, and things. So I'm very concerned to hear that, you know, people may be reintegrated into the same situations that led them to their difficulties. And also how difficult it is if you have a felony conviction to obtain meaningful employment and status in a community. So if I could throw in there the concept of drug courts, I would really enjoy hearing the answer.
Your point about drug court is, I mean, that is a state. I don't think there's something like a federal drug court. Is there,
so,
Jim White?
Not in the District of Maryland. There are in many districts around the nation.
Oh.
But that is a reform that folks are bringing. And everything, from my perspective, everything the caller said is true. You know, that it's very difficult to find employment with a felony conviction. The challenges for my clients who are released from prison are profound. And certainly, again, I think for some individuals, it may be in their best interest to remove themselves from the community or the network of friends that led them astray. Again, I think you understand the system has to, you know, allow the individual to sort of make that decision.
Steve Cook, we're getting short on time here, but is there a response you'd like to make to Marty about the difficulties of reintegration?
No, I think
okay.
the statistics speak for themselves in terms of recidivism.
Then let me, I want to go quickly to Bill in Annapolis, who has a reaction to some of what you've been saying, Steve Cook. Bill, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. I'm kind of dumbfounded that there is the conflation between nonviolent drug offenders is being made with murderers. That really astounds me. I'm just really floored to hear that. I should say I'm disgusted to hear that. That's
okay. I get the core of your point, and I'd like to give Steve Cook a chance to respond because I know he has some thoughts about this. Steve Cook, the conflation we have just a few minutes.
Okay, well, just real quickly, if you look at our history, what you'll find is these mandatory minimum penalties were put in place in the mid-'80s when crack dealers ruled the streets across the country by the use of violence. Why we would think that when they come out of prison that they're going to act any differently is beyond me. These are dangerous, violent, repeat offenders who will prey on our citizens.
I think that's probably I'll give you one short last word.
I'm tempted to quote Hillary Clinton. No, I don't have anything to say, but I guess I would just say that I'm more optimistic than Steve about my clients.
It's obviously a debate that is going to continue, and I'm grateful to you both for helping tee it up for us. Steve Cook, president of the National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys, and Jim White, the federal public defender for the District of Maryland. This is an important conversation. We're going to continue it on the state level on October 28th with the head of Governor Hogan's Office of Crime Control and Prevention, and we'll be interested in your participating then. I am grateful to the listeners who called and wrote us. I'm also grateful to Eddie's of Roland Park for supplying lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features unique sandwiches and salads with specials each day, all listed on their website, www.eddiesofrolandpark.com. So now, stay tuned for Here and Now, and join us again tomorrow at noon for Midday's News Roundup. We plan to lead off with a look at this week's police protests at City Hall. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you've been with us. Come back tomorrow.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Dronberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.